It's just me in the park today. No one playing on the equipment or fossil hunting.
Some people send their interns out for coffee. We send ours fossil hunting. Kyle went to Brookside Park yesterday to look for remnants of ancient life that we'd heard might be embedded in the rocks, right by the playground.
In this big brown gray rock, I found a darker gray lump. Looks like some sort of seashell or the top of a croissant with tight ridges. I dug through the app, and my best guess is Sintina Miki.
The app Kyle's talking about is new. It's called the Digital Atlas of Ancient Life. It works like this. You're holding something you suspect is a fossil in your hand. You pull up the app. It shows you a set of images, and you click on the one that most closely resembles your find, like a suspect lineup only for fossils. Each time you make a choice, you're presented a new set of options, narrowing down the possibilities. If you don't see anything on the app that vaguely matches your fossil, there's a good chance that what you've got in your hands isn't a fossil, but just some litter caked in dirt or something like that. Hey, you gotta find out somehow. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll be talking with the co-creator of the Digital Atlas of Ancient Life. Bruce Lieberman is a paleontologist at KU. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. Great to be here.
Did Kyle use your app correctly?
Yeah, he did. Actually, that's really great. And the potential identification that he had is a very plausible one. And one additional thing I could say that he could have done is that when he clicked on that species, there's also a map function. So you can click on the map and see if that particular type of seashell, in fact, it's a brachiopod, had previously been found in that area, and that could help pin it down a bit better. But he used it exactly the way we were hoping it would be used.
What is a Sintina Miki? Tell us more about that.
Well, basically, a lot of the life forms that you're going to find in this area, the Kansas City metropolitan area, both on the Kansas and the Missouri side, lived about 290 million years ago. At that time, this part of the United States was underwater. And so there's a rich profusion and variety of marine organisms that live there. And one of the main things that we focus on are the organisms without backbones or invertebrates. So the type of thing that he found, in a way, it looks quite a bit like a clam, but actually it's not a clam. It's a brachiopod. It's got two shell valves, and there's sort of a mushy thing inside of it, just like clams, but they are fundamentally different in their structure.
What's the big difference? I mean, in terms a layperson can understand.
There's two ways that I like to try and describe it, the differences. The first involves the shell. So if you happen to have a clam and you looked at it where the two valves meet, it's almost like that's a line of symmetry or a mirror. And on each side of that line, you'd see a shell that's pretty much identical. But in the case of the brachiopod, where their valves meet, that's not the line that they're symmetrical. Rather, sort of, if you did a perpendicular line to that, it's on either side of that line. So it's not across the different valves, but between the two valves that they're sort of mirror images of each other. And then the other difference involves the soft tissues. Now, rarely would we find those in the fossil record, but inside of a clam, there's a big muscular foot that they use to move around. And that's actually the part for people who like to eat clams, especially fried clams, and I'm one of those people. That makes really good eating.
The tasty part.
By contrast, yeah, that's the tasty part. Exactly right. The other bits, not always so tasty, I must confess, inside of a clam. By contrast, in a brachiopod, though this is a judgment call, there really are no tasty parts. There's no big muscular foot. And that, partly because of this, brachiopods, once they land somewhere, they can't move around much, or at least most brachiopods, whereas a clam can move. Instead, in the brachiopod, there are these two little whirly structures, and that's how they sort of they filter in water and catch tiny little organisms on those whirly structures. But most people, maybe nobody, would want to eat those.
So they still exist. They just happen to, like, not so much here except in fossil form.
Yes. And so, like, that particular species is no longer alive. All the species that we find in these rocks around here have been dead for hundreds of millions of years. But the major group that they belong to, the brachiopods, is still around, but they're a lot rarer than they used to be. Sort of almost what Kyle was doing was really, in a sense, when you look at a bed of rocks that you see in a park or anywhere else, in most cases, what you're really doing is it's almost like you're walking down an ancient beach or seashore that existed hundreds of millions of years ago. And today, if we're at the beach, we'd be walking on the beach picking up shells. Well, what he was doing was picking up shells that were on the beach hundreds of millions of years ago. And that group that species belonged to, the brachiopods, is still around today, but they're a lot rarer, actually. Whereas, by contrast, back then, the clams were pretty rare, and today they're more common.
What inspired you to think about creating new technology for amateur fossil hunters? I mean, there's kind of a conceptual disconnect, in my mind anyway, between connecting with 21st century technology on a cell phone and digging for remnants of ancient life in the dirt.
You're right. There is a disconnect. And it was kind of a variety of reasons that inspired us to do this. So first, we were funded by a National Science Foundation grant. And really, one of the aims is that at the University of Kansas, at our Natural History Museum, and indeed at many museums, natural history museums throughout the country and even the world, there are literally and figuratively tons and tons of fossils that are present, but they're present they're in drawers and cabinets that really nobody can access unless they were to come to visit the Lawrence campus at Kansas, which of course is a great thing to do. I would really encourage everybody to come visit, but sometimes that's just not feasible or possible. So partly what we were doing with this project was making the contents of these drawers, the fossils that are present, and also where they occurred or where they were found, rather. So available to researchers throughout the country and throughout the globe. And when you do that, it makes it possible to do studies like to look at how things like climate change affect species through time. But by the same token, we also recognize that a lot of the specimens that we have inside of museum drawers, just like scientific researchers can't access them, the general public couldn't access them either, and we know that there's really a large variety of people who are interested in paleontology, and we don't like to call them amateurs, actually. The preferred term that we use is avocational paleontologists, and the reason why we use that is because sometimes, or really maybe a lot of the time, the amateur paleontologists are better at finding fossils than we are. It's just they usually don't get paid for it. So we thought that, hey, a lot of this material that we have in drawers could be of interest to somebody who's interested in fossils in Missouri or Kansas, or even teachers and for their classrooms in Missouri and Kansas, really to provide information about the fossils, where you can find them, and what they look like. And ultimately, we put the information first on the web, to provide information on the fossils and also things about the species evolution and their ecology. And then really the decision to make an app was partly inspired by the fact that we recognized a lot of times when people come into contact with fossils, they'll typically be outdoors, and they might not be in a wireless zone, or they're probably not, and they might even be outside of cell phone coverage, or at least data access would be expensive. So we wanted to make it possible for people to identify the fossils they collected out in the field in real time. And that's sort of how the genesis for the app kind of came to our mind, and we were hoping that it would ultimately come to fruition. And thanks to the help of some great programmers and other folks at the University of Kansas and the other scientists that I was collaborating with, ultimately we were able to do that.
You know, can we talk about this whole amateur versus avocational thing for just another second? Because the word amateur, I mean, maybe some people think of that as an insult, but I think it's kind of a compliment, because the root of that is like amor, like love in Latin. And so it's like people doing something for the love of it rather than for financial compensation. And I wonder if through that lens that term bothers you as much, because I kind of like it and I kind of maybe want to keep using it, but I don't want to offend you.
You definitely aren't offending me. And, you know, that is a really good sort of I like your use of the etymological root there. And I didn't think of that. So actually, you're right. So please go ahead. Anybody use the term that likes it. I just didn't want anybody who might be called an amateur to feel offended if I use that term. Because sometimes, you know, there's that sort of attitude of, oh, leave this to the professionals. You know what I mean? So,
well,
yes, I think that
you can keep
the
using
term amateur is great by me.
Okay.
I'm totally cool with amateur. I just didn't want to sound like a haughty paleontologist by using it.
Well, no. I mean, now that we've got our terminology clear, as a professional, what do you think is the role of the amateur or avocational fossil hunter? I mean, presumably a professional doesn't need the app, so you must see some value in other people also taking an interest in this stuff.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So one of the things that really has kind of exploded on the scientific scene in the last few years has been the opportunity to do what are referred to as citizen science initiatives, which basically means that ultimately information that are collected by the general public or amateurs can be used by scientists. And the truth of the matter is that a lot of the time I won't have the opportunity to go out in the field. In fact, field collecting is not my main focus. I do it sometimes, but it's not my primary focus. And it's often those people who, as you said, they're amateurs, they're really passionate about it. They'll be out collecting at localities when it's snowing, and they'll be using a broom to sweep off the snow so they can collect more fossils. So one of the long-term goals that we hope to ultimately use the app, and this will require a bit of modification, is to make it possible with the appropriate permissions for various folks to add new information, maybe new occurrence or distribution sites for the fossils, or perhaps new species that are recovered as well, so that that information could be directly uploaded. We're not quite there yet, but at least we saw this as a way of maybe making a firmer and easier means of interacting between amateur and the paleontological community.
Where are you from originally?
Originally, I'm from New York City.
On the face of it, that is a pretty unlikely place to become obsessed with the wonders of the natural world. How did you become interested in fossils?
Yeah, that's really a great question, Gina. So what happened was my parents, when I was 3 years old, took me to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and I fell in love with the Tyrannosaurus Rex specimen that I'm not, you know, sort of, this is in an amateur sense. I fell in love with that specimen. I just, you know, became so passionate about paleontology that I kind of made my parents take me there at least once a week, probably much to their chagrin. And so really that was sort of what ultimately got me interested in paleontology as a child. However, as I grew a bit older, I kind of, and I should say then, you know, I was sort of totally committed to the field of paleontologist and had my heart set on becoming a paleontologist. But sort of by the time I became 10 in my teenage years, I sort of left that idea behind. But then I took an awesome class when I was in college offered by a very famous paleontologist, Stephen Jay Gould, and that sort of rekindled my interest in paleontology, and it sort of changed my thoughts and ideas about what paleontology could do.
When
I was a little kid,
I
was really just fascinated by the magnificent animals, the dinosaurs, these giant mammals that you'd see in the museum, and it was almost, in a way, it's like seeing a prehistoric zoo. And you got to use your imagination to really think about what these animals would have looked like. And by the time I was in college, and especially after taking this course, I realized that what we can study in the fossil record really can make important contributions to the field of evolutionary biology. And that's sort of what rekindled my passion, because I became very excited about using fossils to study evolution in deep time.
In your own experience, have you gotten to do a lot of fossil hunting yourself, like a lot of field work?
You know, I have. As I get older, the amount has lessened. I don't know if that's on purpose or maybe it's just me becoming more practical. But I have managed to do some field work, and especially when I was in graduate school and early in my professional career here at the University of Kansas, I did do quite a bit of field work. And in a way, it was pretty awesome. Some of the places that I was able to go, I've been able to go to the Canadian Arctic and also collect in fossil sites in Nevada, New York State, West Virginia, even done a bit of fossil collecting around Kansas. But it hasn't been the main focus of my work over the last few years or so. And that partly was a decision based on the fact that, gosh darn it, we have so many fossil specimens already collected that haven't been analyzed, that we've got in our collections that are valuable, that I thought, hey, maybe it would be time to focus on what we've already got
But do you remember your first find? Like the first time you found something as a professional that really like excited you?
Yeah, I actually do. It was when I was in graduate school, and my thesis advisor was Niles Eldridge, and he and Steve Gould were the ones who developed the idea of punctuated equilibrium. So he took me on this fossil collecting trip.
And punctuated equilibrium, that's just the idea that evolution kind of goes along fairly undisturbed for a while, and then a major change happens, and then equilibrium again.
Yes, that's exactly right, Gina. So it's sort of the notion that species are stable, and then there'll be a burst, a relatively rapid interval of new speciation. And Niles Eldridge had first provided evidence for this idea by looking at trilobites, especially in some of the fossil localities in New York State. And these localities are a bit older than the one, at least the ones in Kansas that we did our app on, about 100 million years older. So I was really excited because I was heading out there to try and find some of the trilobites that that ultimately the punctuated equilibrium theory had been developed based on. And I got out of the car and there was this sort of rubble heap, and I found a head of a complete, fairly rare trilobite right on the top of this rubble heap. Now, the rest of my time out on that day, we really basically spent looking for my advisor's lost dog in a swamp. But it was finding that trilobite head that really kind of jazzed me, because I'm like, hey, I can actually find something. It made me feel good.
Talk to me about Kansas and Missouri from a fossil hunter's perspective. What's out there for local fossil hunters to find, and how did it end up here?
Well, both Kansas and Missouri have great fossil deposits. And they represent in some respects different time periods. So sort of especially as you get further east into Missouri, east of the KC Metro, it's somewhat of a different area than what you have in the KC Metro and west. But at the time that the fossils that we focused on were deposited, this was again about 290 million years ago, most of North America, not all of it, but most of it was under ocean water. And Kansas and Missouri would have been close to the equator, actually a little bit south of the equator. So it was sort of a setting that at least periodically was a very tropical marine environment. It would have been nice. The sort of the closest thing would be something like the Bahamas, maybe, or the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. So very different from what we have today.
Well, when KCUR's Central Standard returns from this short break, we'll bring an amateur fossil hunter in on the discussion, and we'd love to hear from you too. Have you found something intriguing embedded in the earth here in Missouri or Kansas? Tell us the story and ask the expert about it. 816-235-288. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Good morning, Sunshines. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, and I'm your host, Gina Kaufman. We've been chatting with Bruce Lieberman, a paleontologist at KU's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. He's just co-created an app for fossil hunters called the Digital Atlas of Ancient Life. Hi again, Bruce.
Hi, Gina.
You can call 816-235-2888 with a story about an intriguing fossil find in Kansas or Missouri. We'll get to those calls shortly, so now's the time. Now, let's welcome Brent Jackson to the conversation. Brent and I go way back. He's kind of a jack of all trades, but one of his many active hobbies is fossil hunting on the amateur level. No insult meant by that. Hi, Brent. How's it going?
Hi, Gina. How you doing? Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Brent.
Bruce was just telling us about some of the fossils that are plentiful in the Kansas and Missouri landscape. Have you found any of the things that he was talking about?
The brachiopod's pretty common, and Bruce's focus is on the invertebrates, and that's what I first saw growing up. If you live in Kansas City, you're aware of shells in our sedimentary rocks. I mean, I think any kid sees that, and I saw that.
It kind of freaks out.
Yeah, it's very strange because you're like, why are these shells here? And I wasn't really into fossil hunting beyond just like seeing those shells. And then I think when we were, I don't know, I was like maybe a sixth or seventh grader, we went to a road cut, and then we were doing fossil hunting
As like a field trip?
As a field trip, and that's where I think I found my first crinoid, which actually I brought a bunch of crinoids with me here.
Yeah, you've got a whole tub of things you found.
So these are crinoids.
It's a little jar.
It looks like
dog food, actually.
Well, you kind of see them. I mean, they're different shapes. They're different sizes, and I guess they're technically, paleontologically, they are sea lilies. If I'm getting that right,
but
they're
is that right,
yeah,
Bruce?
That's absolutely right. Yep, that's he's right. Absolutely right.
So they're the most sort of common, kind of what I call for me. I'm not a professional.
See, that's why I was when I see when that term professional. It just sounds so bad. So
I think
of you as
it's one of those things of that the crinoid is the coolest of the dull fossils you find. So it's like if I find a crinoid, like, well, at least I found a crinoid. And so that's not the most exciting.
It looks kind of like a little tube.
Yeah, and some of them are quite small, and you know, some of them are large, but I didn't really think of fossil hunting as a concept until I was out in college. I had a friend who lived near Great Bend, Kansas, and I came upon this storefront where somebody was preparing a fossil, and it was just the strangest thing. And I later met the man who was this fossil hunter, and he was not an amateur nor a professional. He was a commercial fossil hunter, which is its own population. And he also, I would say, had some sort of unconventional and perhaps even antagonistic views to the professional paleontological community. But he was the first person I ever met who actually, you know, he described fossil hunting like fishing. Like he had fossil hunted in western Kansas, where you're going to find like large fishes and sharks and things of that nature. But he also had gone to South Dakota and pursued Triceratops and T-Rex and all that kind of thing. And so it was the first time I ever had seen somebody actually doing that. I thought you had to have a PhD in paleontology to find fossils. And then I saw, oh, well, you know, people can find it. And the truth of paleontology is that it was originally all avocational. It was just people who were outside wandering around, and then they found something anomalous.
Yeah,
and
like
it was
weird, that looks like a head.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing for my interest is, because my interests are primarily literary, it's like, I didn't know that there's this whole cultural side to fossil hunting, and it's actually very important to our national history.
Explain the cultural side. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's the famous fossil, and it's my dream fossil, which I've never found. It's the thing I'm seeking is the mastodon tooth. There's a mastodon tooth found, I think it's in New Jersey, in the 18th century, and it was called the incognitum afterwards. They didn't know what this thing was. And there had been a French scientist who had been sort of diminishing the American people, the idea that like anything on the American continent was inferior to Europe. And so then they found this tooth, and they thought it might be a tooth of like a biblical giant or something like that. And it became a cause of celebration. George Washington was very interested in it, and then Thomas Jefferson, he became obsessed with the incognitum. So fossils are not neutral in our culture. They have a pretty interesting and sometimes very volatile history.
Tell me what your fossil hunting outings are like. Set the scene for me, from picking a location to getting ready to go to what happens when you actually begin the search.
I'm usually looking at kind of creeks or rivers, so sort of tributary streams, because what you want with fossils is sort of a disturbed ground. So anything that's a water course, it's like just like a gold mining thing. It's that you would have, it's like it's sluicing material out. So that's where I'm looking. And depending on where I'm going, I put on a higher level of gear or less. But my main area, I go to some creeks in Missouri, sort of north of the river. And then my main area is the Kaw River in Kansas.
Why do you do this? I mean, you're a busy guy. You teach in the English department at the Johnson County Community College. You have a family, like two little kids. You're also involved in art. You make Kansas-themed prints. So you aren't like looking for a way to while away your plentiful spare time, I'm guessing.
Well, part of it, I do have a literary goal associated with, I mean, the fossil hunting is, I'm doing a writing project associated with it. But it's also the real thing about fossil hunting is an excuse to go outside. And like on the Kaw, like, for example, this bottle that I have these crinoids in, I found this bottle on the Kaw, and it's about 100 years old.
That's
you know?
Cool.
So it's stuff like that, so that the fossil hunting is connected with just one being outdoors, And then the real thing with the false haunting is like on the call, there's that possibility that you will find the jackpot. You know, Bruce is into the invertebrates. I pull out some more invertebrates here. Okay. You'll have to describe it with your radio skills here. But these are coral. Yeah. You know, and so it's like you can see compared to the crinoid's not that exciting. But, you know, when you see...
It's like swirly tubes, bigger than than the dog food looking tubes and more like ridged.
Yeah, and it's usually called a horn coral, but there's a deposit.
Yeah, like a horn.
Yeah, there's a deposit that I found that, like, depending on what the water level is, the matrix, the thing that a fossil is contained in, sometimes if the water level's right, you can basically just pull it out of the stone. And so that's pretty cool. So it's just going out there and seeking things out. But the dream is always, for me, the big vertebrate fossils, which in Kansas and Missouri are the Pleistocene mammals. Those are my dream pieces. So,
you know, I'm wondering if you look at your surroundings differently as a result of your fossil hunting experience.
Oh, absolutely. Because it's and the thing is, I'm interested in the Pleistocene because the nice thing about the Pleistocene is it's also a time when there was human contact. So Bruce may have to correct. I think a fossil has to be 5,000 years old or older. Is that right, Bruce? Do you know that?
10,000.
10,000,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you're very close.
Okay.
On a geological time.
10,000.
It's nothing.
So, but the idea of, you know, Kansas City has been, to the archaeological records, been inhabited for 2,000 years straight, and then evidence of 5,000, and then the record gets fuzzier. But sometimes if you're finding a bone, you know, that could be very, very old. It was also when there was, you know, human contact. So that's kind of a cool element as well. And it starts changing. A lot of times in the Midwest, we don't really see ourselves as, well, we sometimes have poor self-esteem because we think nothing was here and nobody was here. But there were people here, and there were also woolly mammoths and mastodons. And there's a bison called the bison latifrons, which is this gigantic buffalo with a 6-foot horn spread, and it makes things exciting, I guess.
Have you found something that you haven't been able to identify or wrap your mind around yet? Because, you know, we've got Bruce Lieberman on the phone. He's a paleontologist. He might be able to help.
Yeah, I have a weird bone.
Just Brent Jackson has just one weird bone,
yeah,
everybody.
Yeah, weird bone.
I can find it. Oh, wow. That's not the color I associate with bone.
Well, see, this is the other thing about fossil content, and particularly on the river, it often is mineralized and it changes color. Like if you go to KU's Natural History Museum, when you see most of the bones, they're usually kind of like a chocolate brown. Because
yeah, and that's how this one looks.
You know, and so I've had a friend who thought this was like a foot bone. Kind of the most common bones you find are vertebrae, and at first glimpse it looks like a vertebrae, but it's not a vertebrae. So I mean, this is kind of a weird one I found out on the sandbar on the call, and I've needed to bring it into KU, but I never have.
So Bruce, you can't see it, but do you have any thoughts from what you're hearing?
Well, I think there is a good chance that this might be one of the fossil mammals that Brent was talking about. You know, there is this great record in the Kaw. Periodically, you see these discoveries, actually even in the Wakarusa River about a decade ago, a mammoth was discovered. And there's this whole host of very large mammals that until recently, 10,000 years ago, were present in this area. And I totally agree with what Brent is saying, too. It's really fascinating to have that connection to nature and sort of in that broader scale to think that, hey, 10,000 years ago, there was a giant relative of an elephant or of the modern camel that was walking through this part of the world is fascinating. So it is very probable that, and actually I should say too, it could well be a leg bone. Those are a bit more resistant or resilient. The most resistant things are teeth, but sort of after that, you can get large leg bones. And it is very possible that he has found some kind of ungulate. Even if I saw it, I might not be able to.
Horned creature?
Yeah, a hoofed creature.
Hoofed creature.
They'd have horns too, though. You're right. And I'm not the best with the vertebrates, but we do have people at KU are good with those. But You know, I'd say that his guess as the Pleistocene mammal is probably spot on. You know, sometimes too, people will bring things in from the river and it'll be like, this is just a cow, you know, but because Brent has a lot of experience collecting with it, he's right. There's sort of a kind of color to the bone that allows you to recognize that it's old enough to be a fossil.
It can be very deceptive too. Like, for example, I found a thoracic bison vertebrae. A thoracic, which is, you know, the big hump bone. And it was about a quarter of a mile from Kemper Arena. So it's like it's in downtown Kansas City. It's on the Kaw. But then, you know, not too far away from it, you'd see another mineralized bone that had perfectly cut edges, which was cut by a saw.
Let's talk quickly with Michael in Brookside. Hi, Michael.
Hello there. A wonderful program. I used to go fossil hunting out in western Kansas near Great Bend area, and we used to find petrified shark teeth just by the hundreds. And my niece, she found a like a clam shell that had a little round piece in it. We figured that was maybe a petrified pearl inside of it. But anyhow, I was interested in a book and this geological reason. I read a book a long time ago. I think it was maybe written by a KU professor in the 20s and 30s, and it's called The Magic Circle. He said that this geological region is called The Magic Circle, and we're right about the middle of it.
So The Magic Circle, I wonder if Bruce Lieberman can explain to us, are we in something called The Magic Circle, and if so, why?
You know, I like to think of myself as being in a magic circle all the time, but in all seriousness, this book, like, I don't know of it, but it certainly is true that there's lots of great fossils in the area. You know, the caller, I'm sure he's right. I just have not come across that term.
So I have to admit, this sounds pretty fun to me, and I bet a lot of our listeners are feeling kind of inspired by this too. Bruce, what's something a beginner might have some luck finding in our area? And do you have some pointers for how to begin?
Yeah, you know, so I do think that sometimes the vertebrates are more spectacular, as Brent was talking about, and the Kansas River is a good place to look for those. The invertebrates, however, are extremely common and very easy to find. So like Kyle at the top of the program, really any place that you can find the yellowish brown layered rocks in this part of eastern Kansas, western Missouri, they're literally packed with fossils. So a lot of times you'll sort of see them, people have them stacked around the back of their basement, and also in places on the sides of the road. Those are really good places to look for fossils. Anywhere you see those yellow layered rocks, one of the things that we always emphasize too, though, is definitely around roads to be very cautious.
One thing
I should say further, on interstates where some of the best road cuts are, you aren't allowed to stop. But around smaller roads, you know, if you pull your vehicle off to the side, or just in parks, like where Kyle was, really any place you see those yellowed rocks, they're literally going to be packed with things like clam or brachiopod shells, also the horn corals that Brent was talking about. And if you get a little bit luckier, you could find crinoids, or what I kind of think of as this, you know, the second most cool fossil after the vertebrates to me are trilobites, but I understand where Brent is coming with the crinoids.
Trilobites are cool. They're hard to find in this part of the country. They're harder to find.
But literally any of those yellow rocks that you find around this area packed with fossils, then you'll sort of, a lot of times you'll see these yellow rocks and then there's sort of like a set of black shales that are interbedded with them. They usually have grass covering them, especially in the spring and summer. Those can have fossils, but they're a lot rarer. And also they're more likely to be plant fossils. So I'd stick to the yellow ones just because really high probability of finding something. Really, in fact, you just have to look down and you'll see the fossils there.
Brent, very quickly, do you have any favorite fossil hunting spots you'd be willing to share?
Yeah, if you go along the Kaw, there's a group called the Friends of the Kaw, who's a canoe group. They've really kind of tried to increase the access. You can start at Kaw Point, just in downtown Kansas City. There's a access point in Edwardsville. There's an access point in DeSoto. And usually there's just a sandbar or gravel bar, and you just start walking around and looking for something.
Brent, this has been fun. When are we going to go fossil hunting together?
Just tell me when. This okay. is the good season. The water's going down, so.
The water's going down. I hadn't considered that. Should we bring Bruce Lieberman's app along to help us identify things?
Yeah, I wish I had used it earlier, actually.
Bruce Lieberman, paleontologist and co-creator of the Digital Atlas of Ancient Life app. It's been great talking to you this morning.
Thank you. My pleasure, Gina.
And Brent Jackson, amateur fossil hunter. It's been fun.
Thank you.
Bruce has joined us from the studios of KPR in Lawrence, and tonight, KCUR is having a podcast party. It starts at 6 in the Buffalo Room of the Westport Flea Market. We'll be talking about the recent discovery of a new raptor and listening to Planet Money. The event is free. When we return from the break, it's our Story of a Song series. We'll hear about Trim by the Shy Boys, plus what you told us about the role of race in your college years. That's coming up on KCUR's Central Standard.